Welcome to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you Mondays, 11 o'clock Central Time, out of Houston, Texas, through Republic Broadcasting Network and its affiliated stations. This is Michel Chasudovsky. The Global Research News Hour is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization, based in Montreal. Our website, www.globalresearch.com. We have on today's program two distinguished guests. In the first hour, David Ray Griffin, prolific best-selling author focusing on 9/11, has just come out with his sixth book on 9/11, which is called Pearl Harbor Revisited. And in the second hour, Felicity Arbuthnot, distinguished author and Middle East war correspondent, joins us from London to discuss ongoing developments in Iraq, Palestine, and Afghanistan, focusing particularly on the deaths of civilians, which have been recently revealed in Afghanistan. David Ray Griffin is on the line, joins us from California. Welcome to the program, David.
Good morning, Michelle. Thank you.
We're delighted to have you. We should perhaps mention to our listeners that they can order your new book, which is called Pearl Harbor, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, which is published by Olive Branch Press. Could you give perhaps just give them the website to which they can and details to which are relevant if they want to order the book?
Yes, they can get it from either Amazon.com in the United States, or 911truth.org, 911 without a slash, 911truth.org. They're having a book sale now with everything 25% off, so people could get the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. If they don't already have the earlier book, just called The New Pearl Harbor, they could get it too, and it really is presupposed by the later book. The two now go together.
Well, that's fabulous. I received an advanced copy of the New Pearl Harbor Revisited, and it certainly provides. It tells us things that we didn't know about in 2001. And I think that what you've done in your books is to document this so carefully that essentially refuting, is that not, I think, the correct interpretation, refuting the official 9/11 narrative as given by the 9/11 Commission report?
Well, yeah, just as you know those Twin Towers and Building 7 had enormous redundancy built into them, we have enormous redundancy in our case against the official story of 9/11, because now the evidence is just overwhelming, and it shows that every single aspect of the official story has now been discredited for people who are willing to look at the evidence. And the fact that it has been discredited is illustrated by the fact that we now have all of these professional movements. You know, besides the organizations that formed early, Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, and the scientific panel investigating 9/11 called SPINE, which have a lot of scientists in them, we now have these organizations called Veterans for 9/11 Truth, with a lot of former military officers, Pilots for 9/11 Truth, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and most recently, Firefighters for 9/11 Truth.
We'll have to
politicians around the world.
David, we'll have to go for a short commercial break. We'll be back with David Ray Griffin on 9/11 and his most recent book. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization based in Montreal. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. My name is Michel Jasadowski. Our guest from California is Dr. David Ray Griffin, distinguished best-selling author, theologian, and renowned expert on the 9/11 attacks, with his sixth book, which has just recently been released. David, after we've just commemorated the tragic events of 9/11 last week, the sixth year of the attacks, and yet we still observe the same levels of media disinformation, despite the overwhelming evidence, such as Building 7, where the announcement was actually made that it would collapse before it actually collapsed. Has the media changed? Has the media changed in its coverage in this relentless cover-up of events? How has it evolved?
Oh, not a bit. You know, the media used to ridicule us as, you know, a bunch of conspiracy kooks on the internet. And, you know, that was possible when there were, you know, a lot of people doing the work on the internet who had never published anything. But then, you know, people like you came on board, and then a year later, I came on board, and then not too long after that, we had this organization, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and now we've got all of these organizations I was just mentioning of professionals, pilots, architects, and besides all those, we have former CIA officials and all sorts of professionals with expertise who support our story. And yet the media hasn't changed a bit. They still either just ignore our account or treat us as a bunch of conspiracy kooks. And at the same time, anybody in the media who tries to get someone to defend the official story against one of us can't find anyone who will do it. I was supposed to have an interview with French TV on 9/11 the other day, and it was all arranged, and but when I checked my email that morning, they said, oh, sorry, we have to cancel. We couldn't find anybody in the English-speaking world who was willing to defend the story, official story, in a debate with you. And that's not the first time. You know, other people have gone through the same thing, other people with radio shows. And the media won't report that. They still treat the 9/11 Commission report and the NIST report as almost sacred scripture, and it won't even point out the obvious contradictions and errors that we point out. So the media complicity, by the corporately owned media, these corporations that are reaping millions or billions off of the so-called war on terror that was launched on the basis of 9/11, you know, it's not surprising that they won't tell the truth, but of course it is discouraging for the future of democracy to realize that on anything of this nature, the people cannot get the truth, except for that relatively small percent who look for alternative sources of information.
But the alternative sources of information have also been smearing the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, if we're thinking of some of the so-called progressive websites, which in effect are towing the line. They are critics of U.S. foreign policy, but they endorse the war on terrorism because they say, in fact, that 9/11 was an attack by Islamic terrorists. I mean, you have been personally attacked by Alexander Cockburn of Counterpunch, for instance, and he uses the term conspiracy nuts. Doesn't that disturb you that that people who are supposed to be against the Bush administration do not want to question the legitimacy of what seems to be a sort of an American Inquisition. It's a crusade. But they also say, yes, we're against the war, but we support the war on terrorism because we believe that the Islamic terrorists were behind 9/11.
That's right. And in fact, the strongest criticisms have come from people on the left, such as Coburn and George Monbiot in England, the Progressive, the editor of the Progressive, and so on down the list, as I've shown in Debunking 9/11, Debunking and other books. And their motivation, the motivation behind this animus seems to be, at least this is what they say, that we are discrediting the left. You know, they'll say, we've worked all these years to build up our credibility, and now you conspiracy kooks are destroying it. They ignore the fact that, first of all, a large percentage of the 9/11 truth movement is not from the left. A lot of it is from the right, people such as Paul Craig Roberts, who used to be part of the Reagan economic team, and lots of libertarians. They also ignore the fact that, of course, we've got all these scientists and pilots and architects and engineers that we rely on. And, you know, they'll make these claims like, well, you know, they'll look at me and say, well, you're just a theologian. What do you know? Well, I can read, and I can read what the physicists and the pilots and the architects and the engineers say, and I can report that to the public. And they just ignore all that and just make their charges. So the left, of course, is, as you indicate, particularly a source of disappointment, because if we would join forces, you know, the call for impeachment would be all the stronger if all the other crimes of the Bush-Cheney administration were put in the context of 9/11 as an inside job. And that is clearly the one crime that the American people wouldn't stand for. You know, they'll kind of forgive these other things, like lying about weapons of mass destruction and say, oh, well, you know, maybe they made a mistake, or you know, they had to exaggerate, or that and that. But nobody would stand for 9/11. And yeah. The left won't recognize the force of that argument and just say, well, you know, we've got enough arguments for impeachment without 9/11. And so the argument goes on, and they refuse to, most of them even refuse to look at the evidence. It's not that they've looked at it and rejected it. They just know a priori that it's not true, or they don't want it to be true, or they don't want to admit that it's true because it will, because then they would have to do something about it and destroy their own credibility and so on. So yes,
but I mean, in effect, when you start to go to look at these so-called progressives, I mean, who claim to be on the left, I mean, leftist discourse precisely should be addressing 9/11. But it seems that this is a form of manufactured dissent. It creates the contours of dissent so that you can criticize U.S. foreign policy, yes, bash Bush, Cheney, etc., but you cannot in any way question the legitimacy of the war on terrorism, which is a crusade directed against Muslims and which justifies the war in the Middle East and so on and so forth. And then I'm struck by the fact that when you look at the anti-war movement, they say, yeah, they say terrorists. They never say the resistance in Iraq. They say terrorists, Al-Qaeda, et cetera, et cetera. And so that, in effect, they tend to serve U.S. foreign policy interests far more than the people who actually support it, because they give it a legitimacy in the eyes of people who are against Bush Bush administration by principle who are so-called, who are progressives, but who believe that that particular line of reasoning, which is false.
Well, that's right, and I just published a piece that's on your website, among other places, that is called Was America Attacked by Muslims on 9/11? And that's the way I begin it. I say that, you know, it's the consensus that the use of 9/11 to attack Iraq was legitimate. Most people now agree with that. But almost everybody still believes that the use of 9/11 to attack Afghanistan was fully legitimate. And that's even been almost a plank in the, I think it is a plank in the Obama campaign, okay, that we need to get out of Iraq so that we've got the sources, resources, to go after the people who really attacked us, who are in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I mean, it's an absolutely incredible thing that people who are with PhDs, university professors in this, the progressive media believe that Osama bin Laden is threatening the security of the United States and so on, that these terrorists are lurking, and that you need U.S. Northern Command with advanced missiles to go after them, bin Laden in his cave in Afghanistan. They actually say this kind of nonsense, and they don't see the hidden agenda behind the global war on terrorism. Our guest is David Ray Griffin. My name is Michelle Chosadovsky. Stay with us after the break. We'll be back with the Global Research News Hour.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. It's broadcast out of Houston, Texas, by the Republic Broadcasting Network. This is Michelle Chosadovsky, our guest on this part of the program is Professor David Ray Griffin, who has just released a new book entitled Pearl Harbor Revisited, in a sequel of six books. You can order the book directly from Amazon or from the 9/11 truth.org website in the United States. Welcome back, David Ray Griffin. We were discussing this issue of the of Muslims attacking America. Is there any proof as to the involvement of this notorious diabolical figure called Osama bin Laden? Where is he?
One thing I didn't discuss, which I'm thinking about writing an article on, is the fact that, you know, we don't have any evidence that he is alive. The last evidence of his existence, as you know, the CIA and other and the military will admit, was either in the fall of winter of 2001 or 2002. You know, and people keep saying, "Well, you know, Osama bin Laden's still out there and in a cave somewhere," and you know, and he's probably been dead. And there are a whole bunch of stories from back then, where lots of people, including Bush and the FBI and the CIA and the military, said, well, you know, he's probably dead. And some people said, I'm certain he's dead. I'm certain we killed him at Tora Bora and so on and so on. But then they decided it would be more convenient, be more useful if he were still alive. So these new videos started showing up. Of course, the guy didn't look much like Osama bin Laden, but the press just went along with it and said, you know, Osama bin Laden has spoken again, you know, in 2004, just in time to help Bush and Cheney with the election and so on. So that's one thing I didn't discuss. What I did discuss, though, is that, and this what this article I just mentioned, Was America Attacked by Muslims on 9/11, summarizes the evidence that I provided in the book that all the so-called evidence that there were Muslim hijackers on the planes dissipates once you look at it closely. And for example, all these phone calls from the planes, the most famous of which, of course, was the call from two calls reportedly from Barbara Olson, the well-known commentator on CNN, who was reportedly on Flight 77, which was the one that reportedly crashed into the Pentagon, and that she had called her husband, Ted Olson. Of course, we got all of this from Ted Olson, who was then the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice. And he said that his wife had called him twice that morning. Each call lasted about a minute, and she reported the plane was taken over by hijackers with knives and box cutters and so on. And he told that to CNN. He told it to the FBI that very day. There is an FBI report that wrote that up. Well, now, in 2006, when the FBI had to present a report on the phone calls from the planes at the Moussaoui trial, the Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, the FBI said, when they mentioned Flight 77, they said, well, you know, Barbara Olson did attempt a call, but it didn't go through. So there was only one call, it was unconnected, and therefore it lasted, its statement says, 0 seconds. So here you have this story that was probably as important as any story that day that launched the so-called war on terror against these evil Muslims who had, you know, killed good Americans. And now the FBI says, oh, well, it wasn't true. And the press doesn't report it.
Yeah, and then there was the whole issue of the cell phone conversations, which were recorded in the 9/11 Commission report from 31,000 feet, and people were using their cell phones to call their families and friends and so on, and knowing that, of course, the technology to use cell phones on board aircraft above 8,000 feet was not functional and still is not functional, as I understand, unless you have some particular relay technology. But all that narrative was based on cell phone conversations, which couldn't have technologically could not have taken place.
Well, that's right. And you and another Canadian, A.K. or Key Dudney, who used to write for Scientific American, had written stories, again, on the Internet, and the mainstream press wouldn't pick them up. But you both reported that the technology simply couldn't do it. The defenders of the official story said, oh, nonsense, of course it could. You know, Popular Mechanics said, 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet, even 50,000 feet, no problem. Cell phone calls were possible from airliners. And unbeknownst to them, the FBI undermined that story in this report at the Moussaoui trial, saying that none of those high-altitude calls happened.
We have to go to a short commercial break. We'll be back with our guest, David Ray Griffin. This is the Global Research NewsHour.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the Global Research NewsHour. Our website, www.globalresearch.ca. Our guest is David Ray Griffin, who has just come out with a new book, Pearl Harbor Revisited.
The new Pearl Harbor Revisited.
I'm sorry, the new Pearl Harbor, sorry. David, we were talking about wireless technology. Now, of course, neither you nor I are really experts in wireless technology, but of course we can read the reports. And I recall that when the 9/11 Commission report came out, just within weeks of that report, American Airlines and Qualcomm Corporation announced the development of a new wireless technology which would, at some future date, allow airline passengers to use their cell phones.
That's right. It was going to be developed in 2006, and they were a little late. I think it has been developed now, but very few planes have it yet. In any case, by the way, I learned something new while writing this book about this, that I had made an error when I said that the 9/11 Commission report spoke of high-level cell phone calls from Flight 93. They worded it very ambiguously, so you couldn't see that they were changing the story. But they had gotten the FBI report earlier that year, 2004. The FBI had changed all their story early in 2004. I report that in the new book in relation to the alleged calls from Amy Sweeney, who was the flight attendant on Flight 11. And she had allegedly made a 12-minute cell phone call. Well, of course, that's particularly ridiculous because one of the problems, as you know, is keeping a connection. And so even if you would just by a fluke get a connection at a high altitude, it would probably last only a few seconds. And the idea that it could last 12 minutes going at a high speed would be absurd. And so they changed the story. Here's what they did. Although on 9/11 they had the FBI go by and interview this guy named Michael Woodward, who reportedly got this call from Amy Sweeney, and Woodward said, well, he didn't make a recording. He didn't have a recorder in his office, and so he just had to repeat to the FBI agent, Lechner, from memory what Amy Sweeney told him. And that was the story, and Lechner turned in an affidavit saying that Woodward had said that she called on a cell phone and all that. Well, then in 2004, they say, oops, we found a recording down in Dallas at American headquarters, and here's the story. Although Woodward didn't have a recorder, he repeated what Amy was saying to him word for word to a woman, another employee, in the office, Nancy Wyatt, and she repeated it word for word on a telephone call down to Dallas, American headquarters, and they recorded it down there. Well, then everybody forgot, and they only remembered this and discovered it in 2004, and they discovered this recording, and lo and behold, on the recording it says that she didn't use a cell phone. She was able to borrow an Airphone card from another flight attendant and therefore used one of the onboard phones. So when you read the 9/11 Commission report carefully, they never say that there were calls. And then Elias Davidson from Iceland sent me this report, staff report from the 9/11 Commission. And in this staff report, it said that the only calls from Flight 93 that were on cell phones were those two that were when the plane was down at 5,000 feet. So the report that the FBI finally put out at the Moussaoui trial in 2006, they had already written by, say, March of 2004, but nobody, including the 9/11 Commission, told us that and let us go on assuming that all those alleged phone calls from cell phones had really happened.
Yeah, but that's because, in fact, in the first version of the 9/11 Commission report, they actually indicated the altitude from which these calls were placed. I mean, if you looked at the timeline and said, okay, we're 31 cruising altitude, 31,000 feet, and then you have a cell phone conversation which is recorded and describing what's happening on the plane, then you obviously come to the conclusion that there's something wrong in that narrative, because at 31,000 feet, they couldn't possibly have made the call. Now, it's interesting that when...
Yeah, but let me just make this point clear. The 9/11 Commission never said that any of those calls from high altitudes were made on cell phones. They worded it so deceptively that that's what we thought. But when you look really carefully, you see they never commit themselves to that claim.
Okay. Well, I when I went through it very carefully, it was because when it was on an airphone, they would say it's an airphone, and they so maybe that ambiguity was there.
Yeah, I think it was deliberate. They didn't want to tell the public, oh, those cell phone calls never occurred, but at the same time, they didn't want to commit themselves to that claim that they knew the FBI was no longer making.
Yeah. But I think what you mentioned, which is very important, is that each time you or somebody else, actually, but you in particular, uncover some inconsistency in the official narrative and reveal the lies, well, then they transform their lies into some new indelible truth, which upholds the 9/11 narrative. It's difficult for them to do that with Building 7 because I mean that we have so much information on Building 7 collapsing and the announcement being made beforehand and so on and so forth.
Did change their narrative a little bit there, because they had been saying that the building came down partly because of fire, but partly because damage from the North Tower, debris from the North Tower, had come down and severely damaged the front of Building 7 and had scooped out, they said, about 20 floors on the front of that building. And people in our movement had pointed out, well, you know, that really doesn't do any good, because if that had contributed to the collapse, the building should have fallen over. What you've got to explain is a perfectly symmetrical collapse where the building comes straight down rather than toppling over. And so in this report that they put out now a little over a week ago, they got rid of all that scooping out claim and just say, well, it was really just the fire.
But then you had this statement by Larry Silverstein, who is the leasehold of the World Trade Center complex, who said we had to pull it down. Or at least I saw the video. Many other people saw the video. That's what I understood, that it was that he admitted to ordering a demolition of the building.
Well, his exact language was, you know, he said, I talked to the fire commander and I said to him, you know, we've had such a terrible loss of life already in the Twin Towers that this building, we should just go ahead and pull it. Well, that language allowed his defenders to say he didn't mean pull the building. He meant pull the contingent of firefighters out of the building. Well, that was a quite a stretch, but that's what they kept claiming, even on the State Department's website, that was the claim. Well, as in many cases here, these guys are so stupid that Silverstein undercut that possible interpretation that everybody had been making on his behalf by recently, and I report this in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited, a group, We Are Change group, confronted him at a public testimony, at a public session, and asked him about that statement. And during his course, in his course of reviewing that, he said, well, you know, this was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, everybody who's paying attention knows that all the firefighters were pulled out by about noon. So he admitted, in effect, there that he couldn't have meant pull out the contingent of firefighters.
But then the other aspect, which I think is very disturbing, and we didn't know it when Larry Silverstein made the statement and the video of his statement was released, is this issue of the fact that the announcement that the building was going to collapse came before the actual collapse. And so you had CNN and as well as the BBC reporting on the collapse with a building at the back of the reporter while he said, here the building's going to collapse. It has collapsed. Our CNN correspondent says it has collapsed. But then, in fact, the building was still there, and there was, a few minutes between the announcement and the actual collapse. And
well, the CNN announcement came quite a long time before the collapse, and then the BBC announcement came quite a bit later, and it came just shortly before the collapse. But the CNN one, I forget the exact time now, but it was something like at least a half hour, I believe, before the collapse. And then a new development on this that I learned just in time to get it included in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited is that there was a report of the collapse that morning, that a firefighter went by and said that the 50-story building had just collapsed. And this was about, this would have meant the collapse was about at 10:45 that morning. So then I put that together with new information. First of all, that there was this massive explosion in the building about 9:15, and this was reported by two city officials, one of whom was a very good friend of Rudy Giuliani's. Nobody's going to accuse him of lying. He was the corporate counsel for the city of New York. And then a report that another guy found that there was a huge gash down the front of the building. And then Silverstein refers to that himself, so he verifies the fact. So it looks like that the building was supposed to come down that morning about 10:45, which would have been an hour and a half after those initial explosions, which would have been the same interval as the that in the North Tower between the first explosion that Willie Rodriguez had reported in the basement just before the first plane hit, and then the collapse at 10:28, so that it looks like that guy going down the street was reporting prematurely what he thought. So evidently maybe he heard these massive explosions in the building that caused that gash and thought that was the building coming down. So a lot of new stuff has turned up, which the NIST report has just ignored, like it's ignored all the old stuff we had, which was about the melted steel and the testimony of explosions and so on.
But are they still saying for Building 7 that this was due to fire and not there was no explosion?
That's right, ordinary building fires. And so, of course, they have to ignore the fact that there was melted steel under the building because that couldn't have come anywhere close. The fire couldn't have come anywhere close to melting steel. And then furthermore, these fire professors had reported steel that not only was melted, but was actually oxidized and thinned. They said one piece of steel looked like Swiss cheese. It had holes burnt in it. Well, this would have required temperatures far in excess of just the temperature required to melt steel. So there were very high temperatures there caused by something that morning.
But the contradiction, well, there are many contradictions, but what struck me when I saw the report by CNN and BBC is how on earth could these reporters have known that the building was going to collapse due to fire when, in fact, there was no indication that it would collapse. The announcement of that collapse must have been made either at some kind of press conference because it was immediately relayed to all the press people and they announced it before it actually occurred. And of course it's sloppy journalism because they didn't even verify to see whether the building was still there.
That's right. And I had traced back through the oral histories where this report came from that Building 7 was going to come down, which really was circulated, and if not in the late morning, sometime around noon, and that's when they started pulling people back from the building, saying it was going to fall over. And when you trace that back, you find it goes back to Rudy Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. And you find then that, Rudy himself had said that he was in a building near Building 7, and he was told that the towers were going to come down earlier that morning. And that was incredible, too, because there was no reason to expect the towers to come down. The buildings had never come down because of fire or fire and some sort of external damage. Building high-rise steel frame buildings had only come down because of explosives. How in the world could have Giuliani been told? And when we trace it back, we find it was his own office, his own people, Office of Emergency Management, that was doing the telling. So they're the ones who knew in advance that the towers were going to come down and that Building 7 was going to come down.
Yeah, well, these are all
Giuliani, Mr. 9/11, who tried to parlay his heroism on 9/11 into the presidency and is, still speaking out as the hero of 9/11.
And you think that he's involved in some kind of a conspiracy, or at least in some kind of cover-up?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt about Giuliani's people were the ones who knew that the both the towers and Building 7 were going to come down.
Our guest is David Ray Griffin. This is the Global Research News Hour, which comes to you from Montreal. We're going to go for a short commercial break, and we'll be back to sum up this fascinating interview with our guest and author, David Ray Griffin, who has just brought out a new book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chalcedovsky. Our guest is David Ray Griffin, discussing issues pertaining to 9/11, and we've just, of course, commemorated the 6th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. David, you have called for a new investigation, it's a new investigation. In fact, there's never been an actual police investigation of this incident.
Well, there's been no investigation whatsoever. The 9/11 Commission didn't do any investigation. That's another thing I report in the New Pearl Harbor Revisited, using the new book by Philip Sheehan, the New York Times journalist who was assigned to work on the 9/11 story, and particularly the 9/11 Commission. He shows... his book is what I've said in a review of it on Amazon, that his book is half great, half terrible. Well, the half great part of it is extremely valuable to us because it verifies what we've been saying all along, which is that Philip Zelikow, who ran the commission, was essentially a member of the Bush White House. He never should have been appointed to be in charge of 9/11, the 9/11 Commission, because, among other things, besides being very tight with Condoleezza Rice and Karl Rove, he was brought in by Condoleezza Rice to write the document, National Security Strategy 2002, which developed this new doctrine of preemption, preemptive warfare, that was then used by the Bush administration to attack Iraq. Now, that doctrine got a lot of attention this last week, given the interview by Charlie Gibson of ABC of Governor Sarah Palin, because he asked her, what she thought about the Bush Doctrine. And she had no idea what it was. And she said, well, in what respect, Charlie? You know, trying to pretend like she did know. So he finally had to explain to her, and she still didn't quite get it. But nevertheless, that is the Bush Doctrine that we now, given 9/11, have the right to attack other countries, even if an imminent attack from them is not coming, and we know it. We can attack them 10 years ahead of time before they can get in position to attack us. That's the new doctrine. Well, it was Philip Zelikow who wrote that document on behalf of the Bush administration, and then they put him in charge of the 9/11 commission, which supposedly would be asking, well, gee, might the Bush administration had any motives for wanting 9/11 to happen? And, of course, they had many, many motives, two of them being their pre-planned wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but another one being to get this new doctrine of preemption, the Bush, what became known as the Bush Doctrine. But then I say Zelikow verifies all that we already knew, and then tells us a lot more, which is, for example, that Zelikow, although he had promised to sever all connections with the White House while he was running the commission, didn't do it and kept going back. And
David, we'll have to...
okay.
We're getting to the end of the program. David Ray Griffin, the new Pearl Harbor Revisited. Stay tuned for hour two of the Global Research News Hour.